Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Of Ontario and Alberta, who are in austerity mode and cutting things, are now going to flip around and say, "Oh no! But I'm going to spend more and spend billions more on pharmacare so that I can help my liberal opponent prime minister make good on a promise." It ain't happening.
That's the voice of Tom Parkin, columnist and freelance journalist, and host of Game Changer podcast. On this week's show, we have a lively conversation with Tom about the Canadian elections, cutting through all the spin. So stay tuned. I'm very privileged to have Tom Parkin online. Tom Parkin is a columnist, freelance journalist on Canadian politics, and he hosts the very popular Game Changers podcast. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about politics, because so far in the campaign on the media, all I hear is about polls and silly controversies, and we're not really talking about policies. What's your feeling on the political parties and their environmental plans? Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. Well, the three major parties, the Liberals, Conservatives, and the Democrats, have all, you know, laid out their plans to the extent that they have any. The Conservatives have a climate plan that's really problematic in a lot of ways, because it really provides no detail. It talks about the idea that we should use technologies to make our everyday working and leisure lives more clean from carbon, and nobody can disagree with that. That's really an important thing, but it doesn't talk much about what these technologies are, or exactly where they're coming from, or how do they get commercialized. And in their plan, there's no carbon emissions targets at all. So it's a very weak plan. It seems to be a little bit of a kind of a plan just to say you have a plan. The Liberals have struggled because they've put a huge amount of reliance on this sole idea of a price on carbon, and haven't taken a strong position on the kind of things that we can do to improve the efficiencies of homes or buildings, or address issues in agriculture, like the fertilizer industry in particular. But the price on carbon has run into political problems because, of course, it's a tax, and there are always some people who don't like a tax, no matter how much they can show that, you know, there's a rebate program for low-income people. Some, you know, there's just this ideological adversity to a tax sometimes. So this has caused tension with the provinces, who are required to administer these taxes themselves, or the federal government takes over. And the result has been a very slow process, and that the targets that Canada has committed to under the Paris Treaty aren't being met. And I don't think there's anybody who's got some expertise in this area who suggests that with this carbon pricing plan, we're going to get to anything close to the carbon targets in the Paris Accord. In fact, Environment Canada, which does an annual report, their 2017 report showed that Canada's carbon emissions actually went up from 26 reports. So these are all reasons to say, well, you know, if the Conservatives have no real plan, the Liberals' plan is sure to be insufficient in addressing the problem. The Democrats have put their wager on maintaining the pricing idea of the Liberals, but adding a Green New Deal component. So this is the idea of providing federal funds to help businesses and individuals, households, refurbish their homes and their buildings, their offices, so that they require less, you know, use of fuels, and they are more efficient. It's talked about the fertilizer industry, and so it's got these pieces that are addressed as trying to, and I think politically astute here, trying to reconcile this idea that environmentalism or having a clean environment is some sort of Armageddon for the economy, but rather position it that, you know, getting to a greener economy creates jobs, quality jobs, often, you know, high skilled trades jobs, and prepares us for an economy that isn't at risk from the kind of devastation that global warming would be causing in the 15 to, say 30 years out. So, these have been the three different approaches, and they're out there. People can read them, people can judge them, and we'll see how people will react to them. But interestingly, I think we haven't seen a ton of focus on these three plans, I get, in this campaign. So
yeah, it's very
a lot of people are saying it was going to be a climate change election. Not sure that it's going to be.
It's very frustrating to just hear the CBC parroting polls every day and not talking about the issues. Now, a lot of people out here in British Columbia rewarded the Liberal Party with new seats in swing ridings because they really believed in the Liberals' plan. And then they went and bought a pipeline, and they're forcing this Trans Mountain pipeline. I don't know how much play that's getting out east, but in British Columbia, that's a really big deal. That's a really big risk for our environment. So they've lost a lot of credibility on that issue. So I wish we would focus more in on these issues. Like, I know Toronto's bad, but BC is brutal. The housing prices and affordability issues. The Conservatives are talking tax cuts. The Liberals are basically saying they make things better for the middle class. We don't really know what that means. And so the NDP, they don't talk about their policy in the media at all. So can you just give us some highlights on affordability issues?
Here's the way I look at the dynamics. The problem is, and you alluded to this off the top, is that the more that we get focused into the daily slagging of candidates and that kind of stuff, sometimes that can be important. We should talk about the brownface, blackface thing that happened. That's kind of startling. But often that's a substitute for any real debate. And additionally, when you have the two major parties, neither holding a very effective policy in a certain area, there's not a lot of mutual interest to staying around and talking about that very much for either one of them. So when one of them puts out a lousy policy, the other one doesn't really want to critique it too much because it would just be exposing their own, the poverty of their own position. So this makes it difficult. And the strategic from the Liberals has clearly been to contrast themselves with the Conservatives as highly as possible, and then to try and pretend that Jagmeet Singh, the leader of the NDP, and his New Democrats just really don't exist. So it becomes very, very difficult for Singh to interject his policy into the discussion and to get a conflict or get a debate about policy solutions on the table. It's just a dynamic that's establishing itself, and something can change where all of a sudden that dynamic starts to switch. But I'm getting to the point where I'm not optimistic on that one.
Just the other day, I found out that Jagmeet Singh, the NDP, are offering dental and pharmacare coverage, and I didn't know the details,
right.
But that's going to be huge for Canadians, and we're just not hearing about it. We're hearing about these issues, these side issues. Now, it's disgusting and ill thought out that Justin Trudeau would do blackface, but I don't really care as much about what he did 20 years ago. I care about what he did like 5 days ago, and on the same thing for the Conservatives. I mean, Andrew Scheer, 14 years ago, was in Parliament, did the most homophobic proposition against gay marriage. So I don't think any Canadians are perfect. I'm just tired of hearing the skeletons, and I want to get on with the policy. What are you hearing on the street? Do people know about the policies, or are they just talking about these other things?
I don't know. I can only read the news like you can and talk to my small group of friends who are, very small piece of 37 million Canadians. So we all live in our own little world. But today, though, or this week, Trudeau did talk about his own pharmacare plan. And that's been, of course, the subject of a lot of push for a lot of years, most recently by the Canadian Labour Congress, which has already brought up this effort. The New Democratic parties in Ontario, in the last campaign and the last federal campaign, were strong in this as well. In the announcement today by Mr. Trudeau, the Liberal leader, was the inclusion of $6 billion in funding over 4 years. So that's $1.5 billion a year. And this would be, the idea is to create a plan that covers everybody in the country, a universal plan with a single-payer system at its core, and that would have some sort of independent agency that would assess which medicines can get on this formulary, that then we would be able to, every Canadian, as a matter of right, not needing to have a private plan through their work anymore, would simply go to the pharmacist and get what they need, and the insurance program would pay for that, just as it does if you break your leg and you have to go to the emergency. Same thing. So the difficulty here is that, as we all know, healthcare in Canada is a provincial jurisdiction. So the trick in federal politics, of course, is to try and get provinces on side. And $1.5 billion a year, $6 billion on 4 years, comes nowhere close to covering the total cost of a national pharmacare plan, which would be in total at about $20 billion a year, according to the Parliamentary Budget Office. Now, the federal government and the provinces already spend plenty, I think about $10 billion a year on pharmacare, because if you get your prescription inside the hospital, it's covered. If you get your prescription through one of the worker compensation systems, it's covered. If you are other people like on disability insurance programs, you're covered. So there's already a large expense in extending coverage to all kinds of people. So about of the total program cost of $20 million, estimated by the PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Office, about 10 is already being spent. So for the extra 10, the idea is we can extend it to everywhere, everybody. But Mr. Trudeau only offers 1.5. So, which means that he's asking the provinces to pay considerably more money, billions more money, so that this plan, his plan, can work. Well, it's very clear that there are provinces that simply won't go along with that. For me to think that somebody like Mr. Ford or Mr. Kenney, Premier of Alberta, Premiers of Ontario and Alberta, who are in austerity mode and cutting things, are now going to flip around and say, "Oh no! But I'm going to spend more and spend billions more on pharmacare so that I can help my Liberal opponent Prime Minister make good on a promise." It ain't happening. It's just a foolish plan. Well, it almost looks to me like a plan designed to fail, which would be perfectly fine by big pharma and the insurance companies. Singh, on the other hand, says the federal government needs to provide all of that additional $10 billion. Because then for the provinces, they don't have to spend anything more than what they're currently spending. And if they turn down the offer of making it extended to everybody for no cost on their own, well, I guess that's something they could do. But I can't imagine a government that, would have that kind of moxie to turn its back on its own population in such incredible style. So the issue on pharmacare, as I've explained it to you, it takes a little bit of a detail, because if you look at the top line, Mr. Trudeau promised pharmacare today. Well, but it's a plan to fail. It's a plan to fail and then him blame the premiers for not letting it happen. So it takes a little bit of insight, opinion writing by columnists, radio programs like your own, to help people understand why that is such a shallow proposition and how we do need to organize this so we can solve the problem that so many people in repeated polls say they want to get the solution of pharmacare.
It's absolutely comical to think of Doug Ford and Jason Kenney lining up to support Justin Trudeau and help him look better, right, and invest in social spending. That's absolutely laughable when you think about it. Now, I'm talking affordability. The Conservatives have offered a tax cut, and Liberals are doing things for the middle class. Now, to be fair, the Liberals have increased the child benefit allowance and done some things that have made life more affordable, but we're not really hearing the nitty-gritty of what's going to help people the most. What's going to certainly, I know many people who don't have dental care and don't have drug coverage, so that's a huge bonus if we can get that. But what are the affordable issues in our big cities? What are the parties promising? Right. And let's dig into that.
Well, for most people, the number one expense in your life is accommodation, rent, the mortgage on your house, whatever, being able to afford a house and take on a mortgage. So these are the big pieces. And as you know, in Canada, we've had decades of nothing but steady above inflation increases in rents and the cost of buying a home. So, you know, it's gotten to this incredible place where we have extremely high levels of personal debt, to the extent that, you know, many economists kind of worry about that, because if you have to pay that much money to cover your debts, then you don't have money left over to buy other things in the economy that creates jobs and, you know, services that other people are going to do for you. So it becomes this drag on the overall economy. And I think we're seeing that now, where people are getting pinched. And then there's, of course, worries that if interest rates go up, you know, over-indebted people, well, there could be some defaulting, but also just, you know, now I have even less money in my pocket at the end of the month. So all the reasons for addressing housing is important. We saw this week the plan from the Conservatives. There was nothing, by the way, on for renters. There's no nothing at all. His plan was to allow mortgages to go from to be extended to 30 years, because currently the maximum mortgage length is 25 years, and to remove the so-called stress tests that a person has to go through in order to qualify for a mortgage. The test that, you know, do you actually have the income to pay this, especially if interest rates go up a little bit, because now you're going to be paying more. So do you have the ability to pay in those more stressful situations? So they want to drop the stress test. They want to extend the amortization of your mortgage another, or give you that option. So really, these are not about giving people more, you know, addressing the affordability, the price. This is about giving more access to credit. I believe, from what I have read, that there are many factors that have caused the escalation, the above inflation escalation of rents and prices in housing. But surely, you know, a housing market awash in credit has been one of them. And so somehow Mr. Scheer is promising that by injecting more credit, this will somehow help people. But we know that that will, in fact, push prices up again. And we've seen the same sort of hypocrisy from Mr. Trudeau. He has recently talked about a first-time owner's plan where you would get money that could be used for your first mortgage, for first purchase. The last provincial election, I think Christy Clark offered this similar, right? There's the problem. It's the same problem. It's like, if I give everybody more money to spend in the housing market, then they will spend more money in the housing market and the prices will go up. So, you know, this is not a solution. Almost any economist looks at this stuff and just shakes their heads. Because what they don't want to do is frankly, get social housing and non-market housing, co-op housing, back in the plan so that there is competition outside of the market from socially owned units. Trudeau plan. There is no social housing plan for Mr. Scheer. Let's be clear about that. For Mr. Trudeau, there was, again, a parliamentary budget report that came in July of this year that pointed out that his investments in social housing for affordable housing was about the same as under Mr. Harper, you know, the evil Mr. Harper, and that it was less targeted on those who are having substantial affordability problems in housing. So, you know, there's a real mirage about the Liberal housing plan, because they have these huge numbers that they've created. They're talking about they're investing $55 billion. And so I was like, wow, it's a really big number. How can rents keep going up if we're investing so much and building so many units? Well, of the $55 billion, you know, only about 10 is actually their own money. They're starting to count up. They run around the country and they're counting up all the money from all the provinces that they didn't leverage, that pre-existing programs. And then you're, you know, saying, like, that's our number. Well, you know, and then they stretch it out over 11 years as well. So the $55 billion is actually $55 billion over 11 years, counting all the money of every provincial program that existed, whether the federal government was around or not. There's just a lot of phoniness that goes on around this. And it's a troubling situation. So, you know, there needs to be a federal housing plan that puts dollars on the table, and you know, at a more rapid rate, but also ensures that the investments that are made don't just become part of the market pool that is you know, affected by inflation and, you know, rentier kind of actions. It has to be, you know, a large investment in housing that is outside of the marketplace to anchor and compete against the marketplace.
I'm not sure what's happening out east in Toronto. I did grow up in Ontario, so I know the homelessness is increasing there, but I don't know the particulars. But from a BC perspective, we've had Liberal and Conservative governments and federally, and there's an area called the Downtown East Side, and it's just it's like a third world. People wouldn't believe it when they first see what's going on down there. And we just had a news report this morning in North Vancouver. They have 700 homeless people in this rich city of North Vancouver. The provincial government wants to put mobile housing and house these people, but no one is stepping up to provide available lands. Nobody's taking any leadership at all. So this is where we need leadership in the federal government. So are the NDP promising affordable housing, Liberals? Because certainly we have a dire need. Like, human beings are all dying over the place on our streets. It's awful.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a couple of things that New Democrats have done. You know what, to me, this stems from the idea that if you're a social democrat, that means that you don't blindly put faith in the market to fix all solutions. You realize that there is this thing called market failure. It happens. It's real. And that's when governments have to step in and address things. And this is one of those situations. And that's why we need the non-market component in the housing market to compete and anchor prices. Availability of land is something that, you know, provinces, federal governments, municipalities, transit authorities often have land available. It's a bit of something to watch because, on one hand, developers love, you know, a great piece of land, and they're willing to build and buy on it. But if it becomes now part of the overall overly inflated marketplace, we've added some supply, but we really haven't beaten down the problem. With respect to the New Democrats plan, I think it's 500,000 units of new housing in 10 years, half of that coming in in the first term of government. It does take a little while to obviously ramp these programs up. Even if you make it cash available, you need to get the projects need to get built. So, you know, there's no flip a switch solution for any of this. Also, however, there are some solutions which your provincial government has taken, which seem to be bearing fruit. The speculation tax, looking into money laundering and how that was distorting the housing market. The upshot of that was that huge amounts of money, maybe drug money, was being brought in, much of it through, you know, a lot of it running through casinos, apparently, where people are literally coming in with hockey bags full of bills, getting them exchanged into chips, playing around and cashing out. But houses were sitting empty because they were really just being used as a bond, just really being used as a way to park money in another jurisdiction where, you know, housing prices seem to be stable or going up. And so that because people who are in non-legitimate businesses can do that. So the whole money laundering scandal that AG David Eby was on made an impact on this. The speculation tax, which means that, correct me if I'm wrong, people who are not Canadians who are buying properties are limited, or they have to pay an additional surtax. So it lowers the interest of a foreign person who wants to park their money in Vancouver or Toronto, because, you know, they've come by some illegal proceeds and they need to put it somewhere. Now they got to pay a tax on it. Doesn't look such a great place to put your money.
Now, one thing, Tom, and I want you to touch on this because it's my biggest frustration. I go to a sports club, and at least three times this week, people who know me have given me the pitch. They said, look, we can't have the Conservatives. They're reactionary. You need to make the best strategic vote. You need to vote for whoever's going to win in the first pass. This strategic voting is just drives me up the wall. Can you touch on this idea of, like, this shallow democracy where we have to choose between possibly someone we don't like to stop someone else we like worse? Can you speak to this?
Yeah. The interesting dynamic is really, you know, taken hold. And this is structured and intensified by our first past the post system. You know, in the riding I live in, it's usually an NDP Liberal battleground. Conservatives get about 15% of the vote. And that's a long-term trend. So for that 15% of the people who live in my riding, I don't even know why they bought a coming out vote, except as sort of like, you know, a sign of protest, planting the flag, because it's not going to elect anybody, and it doesn't go anywhere. You know, so there's all these bastions in all these places across the country. And really, when it comes down to it, out of 338 seats, there's probably like 40 or 50 or 60 that are actually potential for change, unless it's a real sweep, unless something radically different from last time happened. This integrates the horse race story. And the horse race story has been used very, very effectively by the Liberals for a number of years to seize the votes of us, those of us on the left, to tell us that we have to vote for the lesser evil, to tell us that we have to settle between bad and worse. And, you know, my opinion about all of this stuff is if you vote for the lesser evil, you're still going to get evil. Things are going to continue to get bad. Maybe there's some logic to a short-term accommodation of that for some people in their minds. But surely at the same time, they can't approve of it and just go along with it. Yet it seems that this has become kind of like the sleepwalking routine of 2019. Well, you know, the Conservatives, they've got all these really racist people that have been candidates. And, the Conservative leader has said some really disparaging things about people, same-sex couples. And, you know, Trudeau is now we've seen that he's had this kind of pattern of, you know, doing this racist blackface thing. Mm-hmm. You know what? I got to settle between one of those two because I can't waste my vote by, you know, letting somebody else come in, right? By letting the other person win. Right. Interestingly, Angus Reid, about a month or so ago, did a poll. They asked people, which party are you going to vote for? And then they follow up the second question of, is it mostly because you like that party or because you dislike another party more? And in the case of Liberal and Conservative voters, 45% of them, 44 each, actually, of those voters for both of those parties said, it's mostly because I don't like the other party, at least. Yeah. Not that I like this party. For Democrats and Greens, it was about 75% were voting in affirmation of that party's policy, about a quarter, because I dislike another party and I'm voting against the Liberals or Conservatives in my riding. That's kind of strategic voting.
Wow.
So when you start thinking about this, you realize, okay, well, if almost half of Liberal Conservative voters are only doing it kind of voting out of negativity, and there's about around two-thirds of the vote, we're talking about a huge number of Canadians who fundamentally are alienated from their own political agenda, who vote for negative reasons and don't know how you end up having a positive change if you keep just saying, well, I don't care who the new bum is, I'm just going to kind of get the old bums out.
And there's an irony in a Liberal telling me I need to strategically vote Liberal when they didn't fulfill their promise in electoral reform.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
Tom, thanks for spending a few minutes with me. Where can people find your columns and your podcast?
I do write columns for various places on Freelance, a lot with McLean's, but also iPolitics and occasionally for the Toronto Star. And I have a podcast that we put out about once a week. It's about half an hour and we host it at on SoundCloud, Game Changers SoundCloud, or at CanadaGameChangers.ca.
Thank you so much for doing this, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
My pleasure.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com.